Talk given at the Buddhist Society, London, 13th of October 1971, by Feroz Mehta, on the nature of meditation. Madam Chairman and friends, throughout the ages, there have been always people who were profoundly concerned with the deep questions of life. What or who is the ultimate real? They were concerned with questions about the source, the end, the meaning, and the purpose of their lives. They were deeply disturbed by what they could see of life as it was, its extraordinary mystery, sorrow, pain, and conflict on the one hand, its pleasure, joy, and ecstasy on the other. They wondered what was the answer to all these questions. Was there the possibility for men to realize peace and freedom, liberation from the ambivalent condition in which we all live in conflict? They found their answers, and that finding was in their continuous living of the particular answer they had found. This is a very important point, for we are apt to think of the answer as a message, an idea, a doctrine, a system of philosophy, a way of life, or a practice and a method, instead of a continuous awakening, a living here and now. They arrived at their answers in a very interesting way. They discovered that when body and mind were both pacified, not suppressed, but at peace, at ease, they experienced a state of communion in which isolative self-consciousness was absent. In the absence of isolative self-consciousness, the state of communion was a realization, a making real of transcendence, not only in terms of an I which was related to a thou or an it, but a state of wholeness in which the differentiation between the I and the thou or it as subject and object was completely overleaped. It is important for us to grasp this clearly, because such communion is the supreme meditative state, the real meaning of being in samadhi. It is the end of the turmoil of the imperfect mind, of all self-orientated discursive thought, of all image-making, of all striving. It is peace, the fullness of being realized in every single moment of life, in which there is no I that becomes this, that, or the other. In that supreme communion, there is no I consciousness. Hence, this state cannot be sought or found. It supervenes when there is no obstruction in you to oppose it. It is not something that you can attain or achieve. It is the infinite. How can anyone attain or achieve the infinite? It is everlastingly here, now. It is the ungraspable, immeasurable. Can you take your foot rule and measure the universe? Transcendence, the infinite, is the one total reality. If and when I am clean, still and silent, empty of illusions and confusion, then that unknown transcendence functions freely and fully in me. It manifests itself as fulfilled manhood, as the perfected holy life of the individual who is free from all isolative self-consciousness. In him is seen the complete reversal of all worldliness. The perfected one lives in the world, but has ceased to be of the world, not by retreating from the world, but by being free of all the opposites which constitute our ambivalent life. Attachment, aversion, attraction, repulsion, taking sides with what we imagine to be the good against what we call the evil, and so forth. Now, meditation is the natural and supreme discipline of the religious mind. Discipline means learning through observing with an open mind. Our conditioned minds are not open. If you watch your mental processes very carefully, you will see that every single stimulus which reaches you is interpreted by you in accordance with your particular conditioning, your own judgments, evaluations, criteria and values, your beliefs, convictions and experience. All of them have some validity in the dualistic sphere of opposites in conflict with each other. They have no validity whatsoever in terms of transcendence. In the context of the infinite, all our values and criteria disappear. In actual fact, we are always in the infinite, but are unaware of it. The marvel of the unitary infinite is its manifestation in terms of multitudinousness, an extraordinary, unimaginable, incalculable variety of unique particulars which are all in relationship with each other all the time, partly knowingly, but largely unknowingly. And it is this which makes up that totality which is the whole, the infinite, which never decreases, never increases, which is dimensionless, immeasurable. But we observe with minds that are cramped. We don't observe wholly and completely in the immediate present. We always compare our observation with something else we know, with something of the past. All our percepts are cramped, imprisoned by our fixed concepts. We do not perceive as if it were for the first time each and every time we look. Therefore, our relationship with that which is perceived is an incomplete relationship. And because of comparison and judgment and criticism, attachment and aversion, the choosing of pleasure against pain, and so forth, we remain in a state of conflict, of disharmony. Discipline means observing with a completely open mind all the time. Then you discover for yourself in every observation that you make, and in that type of discovery, you really understand. Real understanding is not a matter of having certain ideas about what you experience. Ideas are merely strings of words. Understanding is a positive, active communion with that which you are observing. And therefore, this understanding, born of uncovering truth, is real wisdom and, simultaneously, true love. The relationship, the unity between the observed and the observer is complete. So you see that discipline is not sticking to a laid-down method which is mechanically observed and followed. Something of the nature of a regular routine in order to produce a desired, preconceived end. It is precisely because we bend our energies to obtaining a desired, preconceived end that we meet with frustration, with sorrow, and we are in the ill state. Why does one turn to religion? Generally, because one is in sorrow, in difficulty. One has been frustrated, hurt. One has tried this and tried that. Finally, one turns to religion in order to find comfort and satisfaction. He himself, whose mind is hurt, tortured, broken, whose mind is confused, ignorant, whose intellect is the slave of desire, how can such a person form or have a preview of that which is the truly happy, the truly peaceful state? It is impossible. But this is precisely what everyone does. If anyone, consciously or unconsciously, but exploitatively, says to you, follow this method and you will find the desired goal, you will find heart's desire fulfilled, nirvana, the kingdom of heaven, and so forth, be very careful. Avoid him. But if you do discover for yourself and understand, then your natural wisdom is released from the burden of acquired knowledge, doctrines, systems of philosophy and teachings. The collections of ideas with which we stuff our minds are a burden of acquired knowledge. All one will have to do ultimately is to cast them aside. The Buddha himself taught unequivocally that the wise man sees clearly for himself that all feelings, all material shapes and forms, all ideas, patterns of thought, and even discriminative consciousness itself are impermanent, the very source of suffering, not ultimate reality. The religious mind is concerned with transcendence, which is not a thing, an object, something which one separates from the totality. As I said earlier, I am using the word transcendence in the meaning of the one total reality, whatsoever it may be. What produces all the trouble is my own state of confusion. That is why I am not conscious of totality, as if such consciousness were second nature to me. I am not conscious of it in its wholeness. Not being conscious of it in its wholeness, and also for other causes, such as taking sides with one thing against another, I remain in a state of conflict with no way out. The religious mind, then, concerned with transcendence, is concerned with truth as a whole and constant living experience here and now. Not an isolated experience which you will talk about and flaunt for the rest of your lifetime. That was my enlightenment. Such a phrase would be untrue. The very word my betrays its untruth. You or I, as mortal finite entities, can never be fully enlightened. Only when the finite you has dissolved as the result of the complete transmutation of isolated self-consciousness, and there is only an awareness of totality as totality, only then is the perfectly enlightened state present, manifested through you. The infinite, immortal reality is manifest through you, the finite, mortal reality. Certain clarifications are necessary at this point. Otherwise, whatsoever we consider will inevitably be misconsidered. It is a great mistake to approach meditation in order to solve personal problems. The world process continuously throws up challenges. Whatever you are, whoever you are, our individual task is to meet such challenges in the right way, selflessly, intelligently, free from the drive of particular desires and objectives. How do we usually meet the challenges of the world? This is painful to me. It is difficult for me. I want to be rid of it. The whole world says that and thus lives daily in the fear of suffering. Life has to be a continuous learning, not a getting rid of the undesirable and the unpleasant, which will inevitably come to each and every one of us. If we have good sense, we will not try to get rid of trouble, but learn from it and understand it while it lasts. Any condition, however troublesome, however painful, inevitably ends. But if I struggle against it and end it prematurely, or worse still, succeed in bringing about what I think to be a pleasant situation, then I will not have learned from it. I will die an ignorant man in the end. The great question is, how shall I live through my years, dying continuously in the right way? Because that is what determines my next state of awareness here and now during my lifetime. All my cycles of birth and death take place in my lifetime from moment to moment. It is the transformation of this moment-to-moment awareness of existence which spells the enlightened state. Otherwise, the ordinary state of dukkha, of suffering, continues. So, how shall I die? Shall I burn away like a fire that is belching forth smoke all the time? Or shall I burn like a pure flame, a pure light, which sheds a friendly warmth around? How can I do that unless I refuse to get rid of troublesome things, unless I become free from chasing after what seem to me to be pleasant things? The Buddha taught upekkha, the ordinary meaning of which is indifference. But he taught upekkha as the culmination of love. How do you square indifference with transcendental love? If I myself or you yourself are free from attachment to the pleasant and of aversion to the unpleasant, if you have ceased to take sides with one thing against another, then with a free mind you can clearly see all the aspects concerned. Then only, indifferent to all duals, understanding begins. Otherwise, there is no understanding, and in that absence, there can be no love. There can be attachment, passion, fancy, conceit, illusion, but not love. So, one has to avoid the mistake of approaching meditation in order to solve personal problems. They usually dissolve in time. Who is the personalizer of any challenge which life throws down at me anyway? I myself, because I do not look at it as a whole being looking at a whole situation. My looking is blinkered by my own personal desires and preferences, and by the exercise of choice conditioned by my limitations and defilements. But if I am free from personal preferences and conditioned choice, I can begin to see that my problem is a universal problem. Dukkha is universal and not a special visitation afflicting me alone, perhaps a few others as well. Then it becomes possible to see dukkha dispassionately, to truly understand it, to see it impersonally, as if all humanity was seeing it through me, and thus I see it with a heart matured by compassion. Therefore, on ceasing to be exclusively personal, the problem vanishes. One's own clear consciousness of truth affects all mankind for good. Thus, free of any personal problem, I can be in a state of true communion with the actual situation. That communion is meditation. That is the meditative condition. Then again, there are those who approach in order to gain health, to acquire mental powers, or to experience the supersensible. People practice meditation, as they call it, mistaking fantastic musing or verbal ritual for true meditation, in order that they may have wonderful higher plane experiences. They are probably somewhat incompetent at dealing with lower plane or ordinary experiences. How then they will deal with higher plane experiences is a bit of a mystery. This passion to enjoy the supersensible, to acquire this or gain that, to enjoy bliss, attain nirvana, or realize transcendence, all these passions nearly blind one. And if one experiences something which seems to be good, which seems to indicate that it is good, this means progress, is what they say. All that is happening is that one's ego is becoming more bloated. The real good, the truth, love and wisdom are the innermost essences of your own psychophysical being. So now we must avoid the mistake of adopting any of these worldly approaches because they are self-oriented. I am going to gain, to achieve, to attain. And the fact that they are self-oriented ensures their defeat. The very concept that I or he will attain nirvana is a false concept. The finite can never attain the infinite. The inner reality is more like this, that the infinite comes to fruition through you, the finite. If you are clean, pure, silent, alert, awake, unresisting, and infinitely resilient, then when totality shines forth through you, absolutely unhindered, the organism will not break under the strain, just like an electric bulb which can take the voltage. We must very clearly appreciate all this before we begin to attempt meditation in any serious, real sense. The truly religious mind approaches meditation in the spirit of the creative artist. Your artist can't help himself. The infinite made him that way, and because he gives himself completely to it, immortal beauty is therefore created by him. He is not an egoistic, self-conscious creator of beauty. I am making beauty. It is beauty which has come to manifestation through him, and that is how it is with the person who wants to meditate. He cannot help himself but meditate, and then, because he gives himself unconditionally, come what may, transcendence itself functions through him. And that is the meaning of nirvana, being present here now. Not that somebody takes this step and that step and another step and finally reaches a step labeled nirvana, enter here. Now, the total giving of oneself to the religious life means essentially purification and meditation. Purification is closely knit to mindfulness. Mindfulness is, in fact, a continuous meditation. Purity is the indispensable basis, or else meditation brings you to an ill state, because it releases power, and that power or energy intensifies everything in your psyche, good and bad alike. So that if I am in a state of conflict, in which I must be if I have not transcended all ambivalence, what is commonly called good as well as what is commonly called bad is intensified in me, and the struggle is worse than ever. Notice how this happens in one's own life. Say, one goes to church. Everything is lovely. The sermon is inspiring, the ceremonial most affecting. One feels uplifted, calmed, at peace, and so forth. Then one walks out of the church and stands in the bus queue. Somebody pushes past you. He jumps the queue. Now see what happens to your sublime state. You are in a far greater rage than if you had not gone to church and been uplifted. It sounds amusing, but it is a serious fact. We have to beware of this. Every release of power out of the world of mind simply energizes both aspects of our being as long as we are living ambivalently, the good and the bad alike. Don't play with meditation. It is like fire. There must be a basis of purity first and foremost. If there is not that basis, you will only sentence yourself to frustration. The great teachers knew this very well. Therefore, the Buddha laid down morality as the preliminary preparation. He called it right conduct of body, speech, and mind. Just right conduct. Practice it assiduously every day. First, harmlessness. To abstain from taking the life of any creature and from harming any living thing. Next, to abstain from taking that which is not given. The third is very important, to abstain from all self-indulgence, not only indiscriminate sexuality. Make no mistake about this. Abstain from all sense indulgence. The right use of the senses is quite a different thing. Only a truly sensible person uses his senses rightly. He would be a very incautious person who would say, "I am really sensible." We are all a little bit senseless, and so we indulge the senses and bolster up our indulgence, our lack of perception. We bolster up the fact that we are a little conscience-stricken, that we are living like subhumans, by saying, "Oh, but modern psychologists have shown this, that, and the other." Look very carefully at what modern psychologists have shown. They have shown you that which will keep you in the sphere of worldliness, and they make you a little bit more efficient in self-assertion and the gaining of self-oriented worldly success. All right, if that is what you want, carry on. But if you are concerned with meditation, with transcendence, with something which means the true fruition of man in you, then firstly, let this psychologist be the exemplar before he tries to show you the way. The psychologist is concerned with recirculating the worldling in the sphere of worldly affairs. The spiritual teacher is concerned with liberating you from this conflicting, ambivalent sphere into that state of complete wholeness in which totality has come to fruition through you. And you are a light unto the world. Next, we come to the tremendous teaching about mindfulness, Sama Sati, perfect mindfulness, as the Buddha put it. Now, perfect mindfulness is concerned with the specific aspects of meditation, particularly as a groundwork preparation for specific meditation. Mindfulness itself is a 24 hours a day meditation. It means being alert, watchful, awake to all your living experience here now from moment to moment. But be alert and watchful, free of criteria, evaluation, judgment, condemnation or approval. As you go through your experience watchfully, you will find reactions springing up in your brain all the time. Watch these reactions. Not a single one has any warrant in the context of truth. There, in the context of truth, all our values, judgments, condemnations, etc., are useless. Be free of them. If one watches these reactions as they spring up and just remains mindful, that is, intensely attentive, you will find that they are merely thought patterns, patterns which condition us. They will dissolve away under that intense attentiveness. It is this process of dissolution which is the purification. You cannot become pure by predetermining what purity is. There is nothing which the discursive mind throws up which is anything but a hindrance to the perfect communion between the finite mortal and infinite transcendence. Mental turmoil goes on ceaselessly in the brain in both the waking and dream states due to our conditioning. It is tied up with desire and our intellect acting as the slave of desire. It is this turmoil which is the constant block. When one sees through it and its power is dissolved away by intense attentiveness, then a new state of awareness of existence arises in you. There is a transformation of your consciousness by which it becomes transcendent awareness in which only the whole is present for you. In that state, you, the finite individual, become capable of absorbing the infinitude of impressions and indeed everything that comes to you without rejecting anything or being tied to anything by acceptance. This brings about the liberated condition. With such mindfulness operating continuously, there is continuous purification. Then you can practice the specific meditation which is the contemplative discipline through which all obstructiveness within oneself to the emergence of transcendence is removed, and the free flow of transcendence through you can take place. These are the dhyanas and samapattis. They have been miscalled trances. You are not in a trance in the dhyanas. You are completely awake. Now do not think that this awakened state is one in which discriminative consciousness functions. A state in which you are aware that I, the subject, am seeing that, the object. Because you have gone beyond the subject-object duality, it is impossible to describe that ineffable state. The Buddhist sacred texts, like the Hindu, Christian and other sacred texts, have always talked about it as the unthinkable, the unimaginable, the unpicturable, and above all, as the ungraspable. Now you can see why, at the beginning, I talked about the right approach, the unselfed approach. There is nothing for me to grasp as mine. Through meditation, through the religious life, through what we call improvement and advancement, there is nothing whatsoever for me. And the ordinary mortal, manifested as for a while in time and space. Whatever is for me is something I am vainly trying to grasp for myself, and this lies at the very root of all evil in our lives. Understand this, and you will understand why the Buddha said, "Ananda, the freedom of the mind from all grasping is indeed nirvana." When meditation has become your natural and spontaneous living state, and when you, the purified individual, live in continuous relationship with the totality, then transcendence realizes itself through you, and you yourself are the living embodiment of the supreme, the undefinable, the inconceivable, and the absolute. And this is nirvanic bliss.